want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, we join in conversation with Shahid Buttar. He's the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, trained as a lawyer, and a fascinating activist. We're going to talk about the change of the guard of the Justice Department, the sad legacy of Eric Holder, who presided over obstruction of justice and a failure to pursue many important cases, while playing favorites with people like David Petraeus and pursuing the war on whistleblowers. We'll talk much more about Holder, about his replacement Loretta Lynch, and our expectations. We'll talk about the battle to renew and extend the Patriot Act without any modifications, and Shahid's support for the bill called H.R. 1466, the Surveillance State Repeal Act. And we'll talk about Shahid's arrest after a Senate hearing where he tried to engage National Security Chief James Clapper about his history of perjury. That's all ahead in our conversation with Shahid Buttar. And before we start, I want to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions. People like Mona Kobus, Carl Harrison, Jeffrey Gill, and all the way in Costa Rica, Larry Doers. I appreciate each and every one of you. I invite others to join in. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the home site, on the home page, you click the link that says sign up. And at the next page, you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. Or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers anywhere in the world get a bonus gift, a copy of Pepe Escobar's ebook edition of his latest book called Empire of Chaos. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. And don't be afraid. We have a new Attorney General at the Justice Department. There's a struggle underway in Washington to renew the Patriot Act with or without amendments. And President Obama has confessed to his discomfort with some drone strikes, the ones that he says accidentally kill American hostages. For commentary on these issues, we turn to Shahid Buttar. He's executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Shahid Buttar is an attorney, he is a deft rapper, and he is a staunch advocate for our constitutional rights. For many years now, he has been the executive director of BORDC, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Shahid, as always, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Peter. You're very kind.
There's so much that you're working on, and I do, as you know, fully support the work that you do. Always like to direct people to your website at bordc.org, where you have an active blog and you work on a number of issues. As we're speaking here near the end of April, a Senate logjam has been broken. Loretta Lynch, after a 5-month delay, has been confirmed as Attorney General. And before we talk about her and the prospects for any change at Justice, I'd like to get your thoughts on the legacy of Eric Holder.
I think Eric Holder's legacy of the Justice Department will be disappointing to civil rights supporters for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is this was the era in which police brutality and arbitrary assassination without judicial process of any kind at all became the subject of raging controversy in the United States, and the Justice Department, quite frankly, had very little to do to stop it. It's the impunity for everything from perjury before the Senate by the Director of National Intelligence to impunity for torture by the CIA, impunity even for filing false charges with the Justice Department to intimidate Senate staff after the CIA had hacked the Senate and stolen its documents, right? The Justice Department laying down, as it were, on a whole series of potential prosecutions that that it never pursued, mm-hmm. while our nation's law enforcement authorities remain, you know, relentlessly vindictive towards powerless people committing petty crimes. And I think the same thing could be said with the banks. If you consider at Eric Holder's tenure, you know, I work less on corporate accountability, and that's not something at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee that we particularly address. But if you're talking about Eric Holder's legacy, a big part of it is big banks and corporations getting off relatively scot-free for everything from fraud to insider trading with essentially financial penalties, mm-hmm. when people should have gotten prison sentences.
Indeed. Well, if I can amplify your commentary a little bit, I consider Eric Holder the worst attorney general since John Mitchell, who was a crony, okay. a crony of Richard Nixon and helped run interference for the Watergate scandal. And for me, Eric Holder, you mentioned some of the key points, but his refusal and total failure to hold anyone accountable for war crimes that occurred in the previous administration, right. to me, is obstruction of justice. And I think that he failed miserably in upholding his oath of office, and he applied it only selectively. And if we look at the last stinker, which I, you know, roughly compared to his role in the Mark Rich pardon scandal on the final days of the Clinton administration when he was an assistant attorney general. His final effort at the Justice Department will be remembered as the easy treatment that he gave David Petraeus for leaking right. Classified information to his mistress when John Kiriakou, Jeffrey Sterling, and others.
Edward Snowden. I mean, contrast the treatment of Edward Snowden
sure.
with the way that David Petraeus was treated. You know, we're talking about the leak in Petraeus' case for self-serving gain because it was going to someone writing a book about him.
Mm-hmm.
In Snowden's case, you know, Snowden not only never made a dime off of his revelations, but he gave up a very lucrative career and a very comfortable life and is now living essentially a self-imposed exile, or mm-hmm. I should say Justice Department imposed exile. And it's remarkable that the powerful figure committing the grave abuse against the public interest would receive the lighter penalty while the person who fell on his sword to actually serve the public interest is, you know, getting the sharp end of the spear here.
Well, and the protection of high-level government officials, the selective prosecution, the selective imposition of penalties, it really just undermines any confidence that people might have had in the Department of Justice and, in the bigger picture, our system of criminal justice.
I agree with you, but I think there might be an opportunity there. You know, you're absolutely right that the criminal justice system is going through the throes of a legitimacy crisis that is entirely self-created, right? When police are given the authority to mete out justice arbitrarily on the streets, it's inevitable that people will lose confidence in so-called authority. And, you know, it's everything from, it's not just Tamir Rice getting killed within seconds of a cop rolling up on the playground where he's playing with a toy gun. The Miami Herald released a report, I think maybe a month ago, documenting that for years, the Miami Police Department had been using tasers extrajudicially just to mete out punishment randomly to people on the street who they, you know, don't particularly like. And whether it's a less lethal form of punishment like a taser, whether it's a seemingly innocuous tool like a stop and frisk, or whether it's, you know, the ultimate consequence at the barrel of a gun, impunity for police violence and arbitrariness leads predictably, I think, to this kind of legitimacy crisis.
Well, and Shahid, in the aftermath of the events of Ferguson and Staten Island, we saw Eric Holder grandstanding and saying, well, you know, we're going to pursue a federal civil rights violation investigation. But in 20 of 20 cases that are similar to the one I just described, Eric Holder's lawyers went in and in court, they defended the government. They defended the cops. They defended the prosecutors. While he paid lip service to the legitimate issues of victims of police violence and overreach, he did very little in his official role to really reshape that.
That's exactly right. You know, and I would say whether it's Eric Holder at the Justice Department or, quite frankly, the Obama administration more generally, you know, my critique would be the talk is cheap. And, you know, there's been a great deal of rhetoric in the context of policy retrogression. And if you contrast the state of particularly, you know, if like I look at the Justice Department, I think the prosecutorial discretion that prosecutors always wield has been applied pretty consistently in one direction. And that's meant to go light on serious crimes by major institutions, whether banks or intelligence agencies or police departments, and to lean very hard on, you know, broken windows offenses by, you know, relatively powerless people. And I think that reflects, again, just an erosion in the legitimacy that people place in the criminal justice system. But I think the opportunity there is for people to recognize the need to shift that paradigm where we do have influence at the local level.
Well, I do understand that. The other set of issues, as you know, that I'm very concerned about relate to the so-called war on terror, the prosecution of so-called domestic terrorists. And, you know, one of the great reporters who has worked on this is Trevor Aronson, who is now working at First Look at The Intercept. He was at Al Jazeera for a while and published a book called Terror Factory. And he recently profiled one of the 15,000 paid FBI informants. And I'm just going to cite one of the cases here where a jazz pianist from the Bronx named Tariq Shah was convicted of providing material support for terrorists after he reportedly pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda in front of an undercover agent. And that's all he was accused of doing. He's now serving a 15-year sentence in federal prison for what I would consider to be a protected First Amendment statement. And yet, you know, Eric Holder, who wants to be remembered as the guy who did try to right the wrongs from the 1980s relative to the draconian sentences for crack cocaine as compared to powder cocaine convictions, and I'll give him some credit for attempting that. When it comes to terrorism, he has locked up hundreds of people who may have been guilty of something, but they were framed, set up, and knocked over by paid informants and provocateurs. And the pattern extends beyond domestic so-called terrorism crimes to people who were protesters of an ecological nature. And, you know, the sorry legacy of
Occupy activists.
Yes.
Right? I mean, we're talking about, Occupy activists charged as terrorists. Mm-hmm. That's what we're...
And so,
that's the legacy of the Holder Justice Department.
Amen. And there's one other aspect that I want to touch on. I got an email from Tom Hartman's radio show notifying me that you were on recently talking about the Stingray program. And this is something that I've been covering here for more than 2 years. And I credit a very good investigative reporter named Bo Hodai from Arizona, who first disclosed this to me. But this Stingray system of these, you know, briefcase boxes that simulate a cell phone tower and get every cell phone within a 2-mile range to check in, register the number, the serial number of the phone. And we believe that some of the Stingray boxes are capable of actually copying the contacts in your phone and maybe even listening to your voicemails. And this program has been wrapped up in these phony non-disclosure agreements. We've seen that they've used it to gather evidence and then use parallel construction to convict people without technically using the stingray evidence in a courtroom. We've seen them lie to judges. This is a kind of state corruption that screams for redress. And most people are saying, well, I don't have anything to hide.
I think you're right, and I'm not sure to what extent the new Attorney General is going to be in a position to fix this. I do expect her to be slightly more bent towards pursuing potentially individual liability against individual agents of major institutions found to be engaged in fraud, like big banks. And I don't think she's necessarily going to be any more assertive when prosecuting or choosing not to prosecute crimes by the intelligence agencies. But time will see, and I think that's really where the rubber hits the road, you know, with the we think of justice as being blind in the sense that justice is supposed to be impartial to the sides, when in fact justice is blind in the sense that it turns a blind eye to the most serious crimes. And, you know, will that change under the tenure of the next Attorney General? I'm not particularly sure. I know a big part of it will start on what Congress does. And, you know, obviously there are some pretty active brewing controversies there.
Well, tell me your thoughts about Loretta Lynch, because from what I've learned about her, she's, an inside player. She's a career prosecutor. She went along with the program to find the banks instead of pursuing criminal indictments against criminal bankers. And so my expectations are as low as they can be, frankly, Shahid.
But it's, you know, it's not unfair for them to be there, if only because the same administration that appointed Eric Holder is appointing Loretta Lynch. And quite frankly, you know, as the administration goes into its last couple of years in office, it is the ebb, the low point of its political influence. And so the idea that an AG in the closing days of an administration that has been pretty consistently bought into impunity for telecom companies conducting warrantless surveillance to, you know, allowing banks to remain open because they're too big to fail, you know, and even in the very worst cases, effectively indemnifying corporate fraudsters, I suppose. Uh-huh. They're, aside from those kinds of issues, I don't think there is a lot of opportunity for the next AG to do anything very meaningful. I mean, the most meaningful thing the AG could do is to rein in the FBI, especially in the context of its Justice Department supervisory relationship over the Bureau. But the only person situated to do that would be an experienced AG. A new AG coming into Washington, I don't think, especially, you know, Attorney General Lynch, I think, is a very experienced prosecutor from New York. She's practiced in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And I don't know to what extent she has the networks in Washington that an AG would need in order to more effectively control the Bureau.
Well, right? Let me just draw an admittedly uneven parallel here. But during the Bush administration, we went from bad, John Ashcroft, to worse, Alberto Gonzalez, to worst. The final appointee at Justice was Michael Mukasey. And in his final days, he took steps that I think were outside the law to harden some of the illegal practices that had developed under the Bush administration. And so I'm not predicting that Loretta Lynch will preside over evil deeds on her way out the door. But as a cautionary note, I noticed that, you know, when a bad attorney general is replaced, you have this moment of hope. And often the successor is the same or worse.
I think that's right. Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot to say about it here. I mean, I say with some trepidation as a former resident of the great state of Missouri that our former senator, John Ashcroft, may have been the best attorney general we've had in the last 15 years, and that really makes me want to either cringe or vomit. You know, it's really hard to imagine that being true. But that's in fact the state of affairs. And I, you know, it speaks also to the inability of appointments or elections to make a meaningful difference, because so many of these abuses are institutionally metastatic, right?
Yeah.
Like, can you have an FBI that is as accountable to the principles that, you know, justice is founded on, due process in particular,
mm-hmm.
when it has the ability to infiltrate peace groups, for instance, without a criminal predicate, or to collect intelligence without any reasonable suspicion of participation in criminal activity? You know, it's really hard to borrow a colorful phrase from the last presidential election, put lipstick on some pigs, right? And
yeah.
I think the, you know, whether the AG is Loretta Lynch or whether the AG is, you know, somebody else, it will be a very tough uphill battle to rein in the FBI for anyone. And I don't even know whether or not she's inclined to do so,
mm-hmm.
Let alone whether or not she'll find the footing in Washington to do that.
Well said. And Shahid, one of the other aspects here of Holder that I don't expect much change from Lynch is the inappropriate prosecution and harassment of state legal, medical or other marijuana distribution outlets. And we saw during the first 3 years of Obama's presidency, they just, did a don't ask, don't tell approach, particularly in California. And then as they geared up for reelection, they decided to score points with voters in other states by cracking down on legal medical marijuana distribution in California. And as a federal prosecutor, I can't imagine that Loretta Lynch is going to tell our rogue prosecutor here, Melinda Hogg, to back off from the pot clinics.
Yeah, you know, that's likely right. I don't know, having never spoken to, you know, Ms. Lynch, or having any indication, quite frankly, at all from her record, how she might approach the issue. But it's certainly been a problem for the Holder Justice Department, and I think it's part of that legacy. That you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it does strike me that a lot of these things are in flux. And one thing this is worth mentioning with respect to the FBI issues you referred to earlier, there's a new documentary that's out and just played actually at the Tribeca Film Festival in late April, and I think in March at Sundance.
It's called Terror, and the T is in parentheses.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You've got it. And I just spoke at the screening at Tribeca. There's a very brief moment toward the end of the film where the filmmakers include some footage from a press conference at which I spoke in Washington. And the depiction of both what I would just describe very simply as the corruption pervading the FBI's counterterrorism operations. You know, what you see in this film is a very stark relief view of one of these sting operations, and you see how totally contrived they are.
Yeah.
And these are the cases on which the Bureau has built the case for its ever-increasing budgets over the last 15 years. And you look at the actual facts of one of these cases, and it would be a joke if it weren't so horrifying.
Well, and just
goes on every day.
Just in the past week, we've had confirmation that the technology that the FBI embraced, using hair samples to identify suspects and convict people, is so riddled.
Thousands of cases.
Yes, thousands of cases, including 9 men who were executed, Shahid, based on evidence and testimony that has now been declared highly suspect, if not flatly false. And there's no outrage in our country about this. I am stunned.
Well, I think there is outrage. What I think there hasn't been is any corresponding policy or oversight solutions, right? I mean, I think people are absolutely outraged that our nation's, you know, chief prosecutors have been contriving evidence against people for decades. I think people are outraged that our nation's prosecutors are going easy on big institutions. I think where it gets really challenging is, what do you do about it? Because, you know, one of the big problems here structurally is simply the role of prosecutors in our criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When prosecutors can intimidate most people from ever even attempting to exercise their rights by overcharging them and threatening them essentially with catastrophic penalties should they take their cases to trial and lose, so that's a problem. And that's something, quite frankly, that the Justice Department can rein in, because they are the nation's chief prosecutors. And if there was a mandate and a policy to not use charging decisions as a means of coercing people and trying to keep them away from taking their legitimate defenses to trial, that would make a world of difference. But you won't hear an attorney general talk about that.
Yeah. One other thing I want to raise here before we move on to the attempt to renew the Patriot Act without amendments is that there have just been nonstop scandals at the Drug Enforcement Administration. And over the last few days, the administrator finally resigned. And, you know, they're the kind of usual expressions of disappointment, mild outrage. But I really think it's time that we look at the DEA and talk about abolishing it. You know, we hear about these Republicans who want small government, and Rick Perry famously in the debates in 2012 couldn't remember that third government department that he wanted to abolish if we would elect him. And I wanted to help him out, and I screamed at my TV, DEA!
Well said.
But Shahid, you know, this is an entity that has failed in its mission in almost every respect. It is riddled with corruption. The people who populate the agency feel free to, have parties with hookers who were paid for by the drug lords that they're supposed to be busting.
That is especially preposterous. I mean, I've heard of a lot of ridiculous things in Washington, but that is just completely over the top. I don't understand how anybody... I don't understand how the administrator lasted as long as he did after that was revealed. I don't know how anybody in the senior leadership cadre remains in place. It's beyond outrageous. I mean, it's outrageous to the point of, you know, it proves the adage that the life is always more amusing than comedy, because I don't think anybody could ever dream that up.
Yeah. Well, let me just put you on the spot here, because I have officially called for abolishing the DEA, and I'm looking for a second.
Well, you'll find me on that train. I mean, I think, quite frankly, most federal agencies charged with enforcing crime should be abolished. It's only because they're horrendously duplicative and wasteful. But you know, when you look at the DEA, the other thing about it in particular that gets my goat, it was very recently revealed that the DEA for decades, well before 9/11, was conducting warrantless mass surveillance within the United States targeting Americans.
Yep.
And you know, that's a constitutional crime, whether it's done by the NSA or the DEA.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the DEA got away with this for as long as it did, and nobody ever even told either the members of Congress with the oversight jurisdiction or we the American public, I think it just reinforces all the reasons why executive secrecy is problematic. You know, like I'm offended by warrantless surveillance, regardless of who does it. And the revelation that the DEA preceded the NSA by decades is disturbing, to say the least.
And they captured every international call. I mean, it is astounding. And, you know, that revelation was greeted with, oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, mm-hmm, okay. So with that in mind, I do give John Oliver, the guy with the new Sunday night show on HBO, credit, because in his interview with Ed Snowden, he, in a kind of rude and brusque way, imposed his view, which is unfortunately pretty accurate, that most Americans don't care about illegal surveillance by our government in the United States. But they do care about the security of their crotch shots, what he referred to repeatedly as dick pics. And as we look at that kind of lowest common denominator or below the belt approach to this very important issue, where do you think the American public is? And with the introduction by Congressman Massey, a Republican from Kentucky, and Congressman Pocan, a Democrat from Wisconsin, of the Surveillance State Repeal Act, how do you think that message resonates with the average American?
I think the average American, and strikingly, I would say almost every American, regardless of which way they lean, shares an interest and would tend to come down on the side of constitutional right versus mass surveillance by unaccountable secret federal intelligence agencies, where I think it, you know, again, the challenge becomes how to mobilize and express that concern. And that's one reason I'm really excited about the Pocan-Massey bill, the Surveillance State Repeal Act, H.R. 1466, because it gives not just members of Congress, but also the American public,
a vehicle to make that concern real, to a vehicle to express that shared repudiation of mass spying. And the fact that H.R. 1466 is sponsored by members of Congress from both sides of the aisle for the first time in its six-year history, and also supported by grassroots groups from the left, like Demand Progress and United for Peace and Justice and Code Pink, to the right, like R Street and the Cato Institute and FreedomWorks, with groups that are transpartisan, like us at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee in between, I think that really bodes very well, not necessarily for its chances of passage, because the bill is very visionary, though entirely reasonable. All it says is, well, as long as the agencies have been given a free pass for the last 15 years, let's rewind the tape, repeal the last two laws that enabled mass surveillance, and then start the transparent debate that should have happened 15 years ago and see where that takes us. Even if that's not going to happen, I think the Surveillance State Repeal Act will find its way into a great many federal policy vehicles as amendments to other bills. Hmm. And seeing members of Congress, again, come together from the libertarian right and the progressive left to share common ground on this issue is really exciting.
Well, Shahid, I really want to see that, and I, you know, I don't expect to be gratified by what will ultimately happen with the current battle over the renewal of the Patriot Act. But I feel like there are these gatekeepers who prevent and will continue to prevent any meaningful action. So we see Senator Mitch McConnell, without bothering to use the committee process, has written a bill and taken it directly to the Senate floor, which would enable the renewal of the Patriot Act without amendments. And this throws down a gauntlet with the House over what kind of a bill it will pass. And we saw the attempt a year ago when Sensenbrenner's USA Freedom Act, which was weak to begin with, was just shredded behind the scenes, presumably by the FBI, after it left committee and before it went to the floor. So we can't rely on an honest legislative process on issues of this importance when we have people who are willing to run interference for the spy community and the contractors who benefit from it and write those big contributions to campaigns.
You know, I could not have said it better myself. I think you're absolutely right. We cannot rely on an honest legislative process. And, you know, one of the reasons for that is because when Congress has tried to do oversight, executive officials have gotten away with lying under oath to protect their budgets and their powers. And when, in the context of the legislative serial reauthorizations of the Patriot Act, not any single one of them has ever accompanied a transparent debate of the sort that the president has repeatedly claimed that he favors, right? Another reason I would say talk is cheap. Now, the president has said repeatedly that he would favor a transparent, open debate about surveillance, but there's never been anything of the sort. And I think that the Surveillance State Repeal Act represents the zenith of the concerns surrounding mass surveillance. And when you look at McConnell's bill, the McConnell-Cotton bill, it's astounding in its irresponsibility in that it doesn't even purport to address or deal with or respond to any of the many abuses that Edward Snowden or Thomas Drake or Bill Binney or Mark Klein or Kirk Wevey revealed.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that Congress should just reauthorize everything that's been going on in business as usual, despite the global outrage, is quite frankly preposterous. And no, I would just say to Senator McConnell, I would vote President Bush to bring it on.
Yeah,
because he doesn't have the vote. There's no way this Congress could get away with that. Voting to reauthorize the Patriot Act is toxic for any member of Congress. And a vote to reauthorize it, I dare say, in many parts of the country, is political suicide. And the one thing you can rely on members of Congress who exhibit is their own self-interest.
Mm.
And I think that anybody who votes for the McConnell bill knows that they're going to have a very hard time explaining that back at home.
Yeah. And, you know, there's an interesting parallel because what we've seen in recent weeks are more very highly publicized FBI busts And I'm going to reference the one a week ago in Minneapolis and San Diego, where they popped four guys in Minneapolis, two in San Diego, who they said were imminently going to travel to the Middle East to join the Islamic State. When you carefully read the news accounts, there is an FBI informant who's in the picture, and open questions have been asked about how these guys found the money to buy expensive airline tickets to travel and join up in jihad. And we look at that. It's presented in the media without any skepticism or any challenge to the government's narrative. And then Mike Rogers, the former chair of the House Intelligence Committee, gives a talk where he says, oh, hey, now you can see a very real face on what the threat is. Somebody calling back from Syria to Minnesota, either recruiting somebody or giving the operational okay to do something, that's real and it's serious. And he's saying that that's why we need to continue to collect metadata. Now, we know how false his claim is here, because the metadata hasn't really produced anything significant, despite the dragnet surveillance of millions of Americans on a daily basis. And the idea that somebody in Syria is going to pick up the phone and call the United States and not know that that phone call is being intercepted,
right,
is just downright lunacy. So who the hell is he kidding?
Well, you know, certainly not us, but apparently most of Congress. And it is striking to me that, you know, as we speak, the intelligence community is fanning out across the 530 offices in Congress with a small army of lobbyists paid for with tax dollars who are making the case for more tax dollars to be spent on surveillance. And the idea that we're paying more and more to abuse our own rights, and when abuses are revealed, that we just sign a blank check, as the McConnell-Cotton bill would do, should disturb anyone, outrage us all. And I do think that if any of your listeners want to raise their voices on this issue, it's a very timely time, an opportunity to pick up the phone and call your member of Congress and your two senators and encourage them to support H.R. 1466, the Surveillance State Repeal Act. Again, it would not only allow the scheduled expiration of three provisions of the Patriot Act that are currently up for renewal, it would repeal the entire thing, the rest of it too, including, for instance, the material support statute extension that has enabled many of the FBI sting operations, right? So the rest of the Patriot Act, you know, the three expiring provisions, even if they did expire, the FBI would still be running amok, contriving cases in mosques and occupy sort of sites in peace and justice communities, you know, wherever, quite frankly, they can find anyone dumb enough to sign on to an FBI-initiated plot. But if the Patriot Act were repealed in its entirety and the material support statute were to rescind to its prior version, you know, that would really do a lot to rein in the FBI, too. The other thing that the Surveillance State Repeal Act would do is repeal the 2008 FISA amendment,
right,
that legalized the phone and the Internet dragnet especially and immunized telecom companies from lawsuits by irate customers. And supporting H.R. 1466 is probably the strongest thing a member of Congress can do to indicate where they stand on these issues. And I would just say this, you know, to any of your listeners, if your member of Congress can't support that bill, it would be really interesting to ask them why not, because I think the answer to that question, quite frankly, answers whether or not they deserve to be your representative any longer.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Now, Shahid, recently you attended a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and you spoke up. Tell us a little bit about what you had to say, how it was received, and if they put it on your rap sheet or if they dismissed the charge.
Well, so, yeah, you know, I was just asking a question, actually, not even really as an activist so much as almost in a journalistic capacity. I was trying to get the Director of National Intelligence on tape responding to a question I'd had a chance to ask his chief lawyer at a conference last fall, the Cato Surveillance Forum. And what I asked was, how do you, the Director of National Intelligence, justify having never been prosecuted for perjuring yourself before the Senate when lying in spring of 2013 about the scope of mass surveillance when asked a direct question by Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, when the rest of us,
we Americans, who are not the directors of national anything, are subject to being killed in the street merely for being suspected of selling cigarettes out of a pack. You know, on the one hand, you've got suspected involvement in trivial offenses by powerless people being relentlessly prosecuted, even to the point of extrajudicial assassination, where on the other hand, you have people with official positions miswielding public resources, committing grave crimes against the Constitution, covering them up by lying under oath before the people's representatives and never facing any consequence at all. In fact, the very same person who lied about the scope of mass surveillance in 2013 was back before the Senate in 2015, and I was asking him how he justifies this. The response to that was walking out of the hearing in handcuffs. It struck me as ironic, you know, that there was a criminal in the courtroom, and it was I was the one walking out in handcuffs and merely asking questions about corruption in that setting, notably after the hearing was over. You know, I did not disrupt the hearing. This was as the man was walking out of the room, and to ultimately be charged with obstructing someone who's 50 feet away walking in the other direction is a joke, which is, I think, why ultimately they couldn't find a prosecutor to press the charge, and I'm working on filing a suit to compel the Capitol Police not to arrest people when they're asking questions of public officials after the conclusion of hearings. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I hope you I hope you establish that precedent, because they should not be in a bubble at all times where they're not approachable by the citizens and taxpayers.
And I obviously agree, though. I do think the bigger issue, quite frankly, there is why anybody allows James Clapper to continue appearing before congressional oversight committees. You know, members of Congress should not stand for this. When you have an executive official who's already been caught lying under oath, how their testimony is given any credibility is ridiculous. And these are the very same people right now who are making the rounds on the Hill in secret, trying to make the case for reauthorizing the expiring provisions of the Patriot Act, as the McConnell bill would do. You know, and there's no reason the mass surveillance should be allowed to continue. And the idea that members of Congress would accept as legitimate expertise the opinions of any of these people, Hayden, Alexander, Clapper, who have been caught lying under oath, or anybody in their spheres of influence, is beyond me. And if there were any independence in Congress from the executive branch, which there absolutely must be in the separation of powers, you know, we'd see greater skepticism, but instead we see members of Congress like, you know, Senator Cotton, who is basically a stooge for the executive branch. And that's the attitude that we really need to address as an electorate, is encouraging greater independence on the part of our elected representatives and less deference to the executive officials who they're charged with overseeing.
Well, and Shahid, in somewhat the same vein, I have asked maybe half a dozen different members of Congress just the simple question, did James Clapper commit perjury? And the only one who would give me a straight answer is Keith Ellison from Minnesota. And he actually spelled out the word L-I-E in his response. But almost everyone else I ask just drops into passive voice, and one might think, and they won't just actually say, yeah, he lied. And
there are at least seven members of Congress who wrote a letter to the person we started out the show talking about, Attorney General Eric Holder, asking him to prosecute James Clapper for lying to their congressional committee. And of course, Eric Holder being the, you know, fan of powerful interest that he is, and I hate to say that, because it pains me to my soul, having heard him speak in before becoming an attorney general about his interest in justice, and then to see just the same thing as the president, the absolute divergence between the lofty rhetoric and the painful reality. Unfortunately, Attorney General Holder did not choose to do anything with that letter, did not pursue justice where the evidence led, and as a result, James Clapper is still drawing a public paycheck to lie to Congress in order to protect the NSA's unconstitutional, un-American, illegal, and ineffective mass surveillance activities. And I think the key here, again, is for your listeners to not only recognize how corrupt this situation is, but I really do want to impress upon people the role that we each play. And you each have enormous influence. And simply putting your own federal representatives and senators on the spot and pressing them on supporting the repeal of the powers that we've already seen demonstrated to have been abused by the government is could make a very big difference.
Well, and just for fun, I have found just a little game that I play to make a member of Congress squirm. I just look him in the eye and say, can I have my Fourth Amendment rights back? It's a very interesting exercise. You should try it.
Right.
Shahid, finally, I want to ask you to comment. As we're speaking, it's just been a day since the president made the grim announcement of what he claimed was an accidental or a mistaken drone strike in Pakistan that killed an American and an Italian, each who were being held prisoner or hostage by the Taliban. But he explicitly said that he does not regret the untargeted killing of an American citizen named Adam Gadan, or another American who was killed in a drone strike, again, not specifically targeted, we are told, named Ahmed Farouk. Now, this follows the pattern of the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki and what we were told was the accidental drone strike that killed his 16-year-old son. But we now have a pattern of Americans being killed by drone strikes. And it's interesting because, this to me is completely outside the law. It is extra legal. It is beyond the president's authority. And we see Congress trying to rein the president in on immigration or on peace talks with Iran, but not on his unilateral use of drones up to and including the killing of American citizens.
I think you're right. I would just note that to his credit, Senator Rand Paul was actually quite assertive about exactly this issue, going so far as to filibuster the nomination of the now CIA director, John Brennan, over the question of whether Americans would be killed using drones. And at the time, going back to where we started again, Eric Holder at the Justice Department promised that drones would not be used on U.S. soil, but nobody ever promised that they wouldn't be used against Americans. Here's the part that's really disturbing. It wouldn't matter if they did, because the way we use drones doesn't depend on who the targets are. In fact, a lot of times our government doesn't even know. They just fire drones where the intelligence suggests someone might be, and we just wait to see whose bodies are left over at the end. And that's also terrifying and disturbing. But it is, in fact, the case that drones aren't targeted at all, let alone any less lethal. In fact, the same attack that killed the two hostages, the authorities, when pressed, admitted that the targets of that the strike were unknown. That was a signature strike based only on essentially algorithms about the target's behavior and with a human check at the end. But when they pressed the trigger, they didn't know who they were firing at.
Mm-hmm.
And that should give anyone, I think, a great deal of concern.
We're also told, and this is supposed to comfort us, that metadata, telephone metadata, is often used to confirm the individuals they think they are targeting in a signature strike. It is just this slippery house of cards, and it only maintains its upright position because we tolerate it. And we need to stop being so tolerant, and we need to push through our elected officials to get that message received loud and clear.
And also, importantly, to engage our neighbors. I think a lot of people who do contact their officials often forget to do it in groups. And we just wield a great deal more influence in groups than we do alone. And just talking to your neighbors, getting a half dozen people together who share your concerns, can make a huge difference, especially because there are things you can do as groups that you can't do as individuals, like host large events or bring your public officials, like a group in Cleveland that we've been supporting for several years did just a few weeks ago, and brought the member of their city council who chairs a public safety committee to appear on a panel with myself, a representative of the ACLU. There was supposed to be someone there from the police department who ultimately cited the medical emergency and was not there. But, you know, that event not only molded the impression of the city council person toward these issues, but it was covered by two nightly TV outlets and the major newspaper. And that's the kind of thing
that relatively small groups of people can do together, especially when you come from different communities. And so the work we do at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee is mostly about coaching people who are concerned about the devolution of the rule of law, people who are concerned about the rising tide of police murders, people who are concerned about James Clapper getting away with lying to the Senate about mass surveillance, people who are concerned about this growing metastasis of the control state and all of its various iterations and facets. People who are concerned about those issues can make a huge difference, not only by picking up the phone and, again, reaching out to your members of Congress. And at the moment, I'd particularly suggest supporting H.R. 1466, the Surveillance State Repeal Act, but also engaging your neighbors and coming up with plans, public events, panel discussions, documentary screenings, marches, rallies, protests, simply going to see your members of Congress with six people in tow instead of alone. These are ways to raise your voice and have influence. And when enough of us do this in enough different places, that's when we get the Fourth Amendment back.
All right, Shahid. Well, thanks for coaching and for fighting and for even standing still to get arrested in a Senate hearing. I appreciate all that you do and support the work of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Again, your website, bordc.org. Thank you, Shahid.
Thanks so much for having me on, Peter. It's always a pleasure. Keep up the great work.
I want my Fourth Amendment back. Will you ask your member of Congress on my behalf? I'd appreciate it. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.